This is BallotVox, the Pointer's coverage of the upcoming 2022 provincial and municipal elections. Reporting today, Sam Graywall.
The latest polls for the provincial election, which will be taking place June 2nd, show that not much has changed. Ipsos conducted, or they did it about a week ago, but they released the results yesterday, March 21st. The polling results, according to the methodology that Ipsos used, has the PCs at 38% support, the Liberals at 28% support, and the NDP at 24%. And to talk about the poll and some concerns, perhaps, about the lack of attention to the Ontario election, a bit of widespread distraction, preoccupation, perhaps, we have Chris Cochrane. He's a regular on BallotVox with us. He's a professor at the University of Toronto, a political scientist. Chris, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the most recent poll?
It's more or less status quo, I guess, in Ontario. The Conservatives certainly seem to be holding the line. They're still in majority government territory, which is obviously important for them. There's still, a little bit of movement, I guess, over, if we look back at a longer period of time, there is some movement on the anti-Conservative side with the Liberals coming back from the lows of the last election and now running out ahead of the NDP. And even though the Conservatives, I'm sure, are happy with the sort of continued poll numbers in their favor, there probably is some concern that if the Liberals continue to eat away at the NDP support, that there could be a shift, as we've seen in Kane elections in the not too distant past, of NDP supporters to the Liberals to try to defeat the Conservatives. And if the anti-Ford coalition coalesces around a single candidate, then the Conservative numbers aren't strong enough to hold that off. So there's still a lot of unpredictability, even though things have been pretty stable in the last several polls.
Chris, in looking at the Ipsos results, a couple of things that jumped out at me. One, in the 905, the PCs, Doug Ford and his Conservatives, they polled at about 51% support, which I was a little bit surprising to me. The Liberals in the 905, according to the Ipsos poll, are at 25%, the NDP at 16%, the Greens at 6%, and others 2%. That could be the swing, or I guess it wouldn't be a swing because the PCs already have a strong majority. But, if there was going to be any movement, like let's say the possibility of a minority government, one would think that you'd have to see erosion of PC support in the 905. According to this poll anyway, we're not seeing that. And I wonder, out where in the suburban belt where priorities are a little bit different, like a lot of concerns that I pick up on around the cost of living, a lot of economic concerns and economic uncertainty. Do you think that there are a lot of people perhaps in the 905 belt who might feel that a PC government, another term under Doug Ford would be more economically secure? Maybe they'd help rein in inflation, brutal gas prices and grocery prices, and obviously we know about the housing costs. Do you think there's a sense that we're better off, as bad as things have become under the PCs over the last 3.5, almost 4 years, that a lot of people feel that we might be economically more stable, less uncertainty economically under a PC Doug Ford government?
Yeah, I think that's a very real possibility. There's a cliche in Canadian politics, and it depends on your party affiliation, how you say it, but either hard times or Tory times, or Tory times or hard times. But there is a sense that the Conservatives are the ones most focused on the economy. And when the economy is doing poorly, people tend to pay attention to it. And whether or not it's in their interests or not, I think the fact that the Conservatives have considerable ownership over that issue for a lot of Ontarians and a lot of Canadians gives them advantage when economic issues are front of mind. And, you mentioned a lot of things around affordability, which is clearly an issue. And inflation is at the highest it's been in decades. You think of the rising price of fuel, for example, which is going to be borne disproportionately by people who depend on their vehicles, which are suburban voters in particular. Housing prices, I think, are an issue for everybody in general, but especially, again, for people in the suburbs who, I think, have on average higher both expectations and aspirations to own their own house. So, you know, all of these things are issues that the progressive conservatives in Ontario are well aware of and are clearly targeting. And you know, I in some ways, we could think of it as a good sign, maybe, that, you know, some of the recent political news in Ontario involved license plate stickers and removing the fee for license plate renewals. And, you know, if we would have to go all the way back to early March 2020 before the pandemic hit to hear anybody in Ontario politics talking about license plates again. So maybe there's a good sign there, at least in terms of what we hope is going to transpire. But it's absolutely not a coincidence that the conservatives went after that issue. They saw it as something, you know, that would address, in maybe just as a token way anyway, but address the issue of affordability, and especially do it for car owners who are disproportionately suburban. So they know exactly who they need to target in order to hold on to power. And we should expect them to do everything they can to make those voters know that the conservatives are looking out for their interests.
Chris, I'm guessing that, you know, as a political scientist, you would like to see more substantive policy proposals from the PPs if they're going to run on an economic platform, like, hey, you know, we're going to address energy costs, fuel costs, we're going to address heating costs, we're going to address grocery bills, affordable housing, housing costs, all of these other things. If they clearly intend to run that type of a campaign, we all would love to see some more substantive policies to say, well, what are you going to do, for example, around affordable housing? The recent housing plan or housing, you know, kind of statements that were put out after they had their summit a few weeks back with a bunch of the municipalities, what the PCs put out very recently around the housing issue is pathetic. I mean, short of, you know, building new houses, which seems to be their only solution, which everyone knows isn't really a solution at all. Sure, new housing stock might be part of the mix, or if it's done properly, it would be more broadly beneficial. But there are so many other issues, like, for example, inclusionary zoning. The PCs refuse to take a position on this, you know, and a lot of people feel that, you know, bringing in, you know, inclusionary zoning policies, and I understand that it's a municipal issue. Zoning is typically done at the municipal level, but we all know the PCs have basically ran roughshod over municipal planning authority through the use of MZOs and other interference. So why couldn't the province step in and say, well, hey, you know what, developers and the home building industry, we're going to have to push back against you a little bit, bring in progressive inclusionary zoning policies that see a different mix of stock, that build the houses in more dense urban areas, that provide more affordability in a broader range of neighborhoods with inclusionary zoning. You know, you could look at restrictions around certain land transfer taxation. Again, it's a local issue, but the province can certainly help regions. They allowed Toronto to do it. The province could allow other regions to introduce those types of things to cool down the market. They could work with the federal government on some of the borrowing criteria and, you know, minimum down payments, other issues around the mortgage terms and whatnot. They could do what BC did in terms of foreign ownership and be a little bit more active in terms of trying to identify some of these artificial real estate market instrumentations that have caused a lot of the inflation in the housing market. But again, just getting your thoughts on, broadly speaking, to me, the license plate thing is a gimmick. Sure, it's going to help some families with a little bit more money, but in the big picture, does it address the broad issues and causes of inflation, of the lack of affordability? I don't think so. And just your thoughts, Chris, do you even expect to see tangible, detailed policy?
No, and definitely not on that area, and not from the conservatives or the liberals. And I think you raise a very good point. I mean, there can be a conversation, if you think of it kind of from an intellectual level, a conversation about the importance of home ownership in a country, or the importance of just, you know, owning the place that you live in as a source of financial security in the long term for people, but also as an important source of giving people a real tangible stake in the country that they live in, or the society that they live in. And those are the kinds of you know, sort of long-term intellectual. I mean, I think they, on the long term, they actually are the right ways to think about policy issues and think about, you know, statesmanship and all of these sort of, you know, broader considerations. But in the short term, they would require a political party to try to go out and win an election when, especially for the liberals and the conservatives, a significant number, and in both cases, likely a majority of their supporters, already own their own homes. So you're talking about taking equity away or wealth away from people who already have it to benefit those who don't have it, or to benefit people down the line who might need it. And that's a very difficult message for a political party to send, you know, and expect to win. And that's just the voters. If you think of donors, the issue is even worse. So it seems to me it'd be pretty challenging for a conservative or a liberal political party to run on reducing housing prices in the short term, when most of the people who support them and indeed vote for them are the ones who are going to lose at a, you know, kind of in their own self-interest, lose their own wealth as a result of that. So I think we're in a real jam. I think it's an issue that should have been addressed 20 years ago. It wasn't. And it's gotten to the point where it is now, where you have essentially a bifurcation of society into those who are in families that own property and those who aren't. And the ones who aren't are going to have an extremely hard time getting in, if it's even close to possible. That's likely to continue to get worse as the, you know, if the rate of increase doesn't increase but still increases, it's going to be even more and more difficult for young people or people, you know, without property to actually acquire property. So I think it's a real gem, and it's going to increase the cost of living, obviously, for people who are assuming mortgages that they can't afford, but also when rents start to increase, as we've now seen, and we should expect to continue, it adds an element of uncertainty, and it's going to make life a lot more challenging and the future a lot less secure for a good number of Canadians. And I think over the long term is to the overall detriment of the country, but I don't see any political party proposing serious measures to address it. And so what we end up with is the display of sort of symbolic politics of people wanting voters to believe that. And I think generally they want voters to know that they hear their concerns. So people who are worried about affordability, rising cost of living, rising cost of houses and so on, they want them to know that they hear their concerns, but they're not proposing at any level of government tangible policies that will actually address it. So we get things like license plate stickers, which again, you know, we don't want to scoff at a couple of $100, but in the grand scheme of things, to put it mildly, with inflation and housing prices and everything else, it's a drop in the bucket, and it does nothing other than, as you mentioned, the kind of symbolic or a token gesture to try to bring people concerned about affordability into this case, the conservative fold.
Chris, I want to talk about the lack of energy around the June 2nd provincial election, the seeming preoccupation with many things going on around the world and across Canada and in Ontario specifically. But just really quickly before that, with the big news out of Ottawa, this non-coalition coalition between the NDP and the Liberals in Ottawa federally, presumably to prevent the Conservatives from forcing an election shortly after their convention on September 10th, when they're going to choose a new CPC leader. Obviously, what the CPC hopes to do is force an election as soon as possible. But with this move between the Liberals and the NDP, which, you know, is again, it's again, I wish it wasn't so overtly political. Like, you know, either form a coalition or don't. Either give the NDP kind of a seat at the cabinet table or don't. But I wanted to talk about in Ontario, where do you think we are regarding the relationship between the NDP and the Liberals? If we see things playing out for quite a long time, like the Liberals were in power for 15 years from 2003 to 2018 under Dalton McGuinty and Kathleen Wynne. If we're looking at something like that with the PCs, like let's say 2, 3, who knows, maybe even 4 PC majority governments, or maybe at the best, you're going to weaken the majority and move it into some minority territory. But if we kind of see the numbers playing out the way they do, where it becomes almost impossible for the Liberals and the NDP to form government, or the NDP to form government, because the way in our first past the post system it works, the PCs are in a very comfortable position in terms of seat count. And we don't have to get into it, but do you think, like, do you foresee in Ontario a move toward the NDP and the Liberals maybe taking a step back and thinking about the demographic reality, the seat count reality, how this is an uphill climb for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's from a political science perspective, it's a mystery that they, you know, especially considering how similar the parties are in terms of the policies that they advocate and the voters they aim to appeal to, that they run as separate parties in a first past the post electoral system where all of the institutional incentives are to consolidate the party system into two parties. And this is sort of, you know, what we would expect. I think a part of it has to do with, you know, I mean, those of us who sort of study politics and think about politics, and for good reason, we do tend to think of politics as sort of being organized in left-right terms. And, you know, we can envision a sort of left-right dimension and position parties on it in terms of more or less similarity. But for a lot of voters, they, you know, see politics differently. And a big part of the way that regular citizens orient themselves to politics is through party loyalties, like team loyalties. And so they attach themselves to a team and they cheer for that team election after election. And that adds, I think, an historical source of difference between the NDP and the Liberals. But also, you know, when both the Liberals and the New Democrats feel that it's the other undermining them in their broader mission against the Conservatives, that can increase animosity even further and make it harder for them, ironically, to sort of coalesce and join together. I think if, you know, similarly situated, it's not entirely clear yet what is behind the Liberal NDP accord at the federal level. I mean, we could think of it as the culmination of a longer term trend, as I just mentioned, that they're competing on the same, you know, for the same ideas and for the same voters in a political space, which is true. But I think we can also see it as a result of short term factors, especially for the Liberals. In particular, it seems to me the not unlikely scenario that the Liberals may find themselves looking for a new leader soon if Trudeau decides to step out and be replaced. And, you know, if we think back to, for instance, when Dalton McGuinty stepped out of as Liberal leader provincially, you know, he prorogued Parliament or prorogued the legislature and basically suspended it so that he would be able to do it, you know, without running the risk of, you know, having to face the government, having to face the opposition and potentially even him being defeated. So it's possible that what we're seeing federally is just a short-term trend. But I think in the long term, if we did see a continuation of minority government after minority government with the same kind of alliance, the NDP in effect holding a balance of power between the Liberals and Conservatives, that whether, you know, by sort of design that they plan to unite so that they can run more coherently in campaigns, or just as a function of voter perception, you know, if they're forming accord after accord, election after election, eventually voters are going to come to see them as the same party. And that poses opportunities, but also risks for both the Liberals and their Democrats. I mean, for their Democrats, if they start to get blamed for things that a Liberal government does when they're not in government, and for the Liberals, if they are linked with NDP policies that the Liberals may not want to own in an election, then, you know, then obviously that could work, at least in terms of percentage of the popular vote, to the benefit of the Conservatives. And I guess my summary of it would be that I think the Liberals and the NDP, in terms of percentage of the popular vote, are weaker together than they are separately. But in terms of seats in the provincial legislature and in the federal House of Commons, are stronger together than they are separately. And that's a part of, as you mentioned, our first past the post electoral system. You know, I think the Conservatives learned the lesson the hard way after a number of electoral defeats federally, that you can talk about, you know, big principles and big ideas and ideology, it doesn't necessarily win elections. So Stephen Harper, when, you know, his first successful campaign, you know, he saw getting out early every morning and showing the GST rolling down from 7% to 6% to 5%. So they learned that these sorts of gimmicks, policy gimmicks designed to appeal to people you need to have vote for you in an election, can actually do a lot of good. And provincially, we see that clearly with the license plate stickers. I mean, this is a gimmick designed to appeal to the people the Conservatives know they need to get in order to win the election. But the Liberals definitely have, you know, mastered that craft over the years as well. And so the you know, it's not a direct response, but, you know, the Conservatives say, we'll give you free license plate stickers, and the Liberals Liberals raise you retroactive childcare payments. And there's obviously lots of good arguments for having a childcare program, but to have one that's retroactive and going to give people money for past childcare expenses, it seems to me is exactly the kind of thing that I'd expect the Liberals to do even more of, because they know that they need to get a particular group out to vote for them as well. So the Liberals certainly can play the game every bit as good as the Conservatives can.
I'm going to switch gears, Chris, as I mentioned before. What do you think about the lack of, am I reading more into this? Maybe it's just because it was March break and, everyone was sort of preoccupied with their own plans and coming out of, the worst of the pandemic over the last, 5-6 months for many people anyway, that there was just too much distraction and people wanted to get away. And, a lot of even our politics was unplugged at the local level. There wasn't much going on in Queen's Park, same thing. But this seeming lack of coverage of the election and attention, I just am not hearing much about it. I don't see a lot of buzz. My social media feeds are very quiet on the provincial election front. I look at the headlines, same thing. Do you think that, with Ukraine and Russia, with just the immense amount of anticipation to move out of the pandemic and get away from anything even loosely associated with politics, we've seen these faces for the last 2 years. We've seen Doug Ford on TV constantly. We've seen other politicians more than usual because of the intimacy around the pandemic coverage and the need to be kind of engaged to know what was going on at a certain level. Do you think all of this is culminating in a bit of public apathy, a little bit of, distraction? Are you concerned that we might not get, the usual type of provincial election or attention to it? And if that might be the case, who would that benefit? Who would it hurt?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you're exactly right. People are, people can get sick of politicians. I think back to, right around 2004, for example, when Paul Martin became the federal Liberal leader, and clearly in around that time made it a big part of his persona to appear every day in front of a camera. And I think people got sick of him. So, you can have that sort of overexposure, I think can be an issue. But, as you mentioned, the pandemic, obviously, it's a once in a century, worldwide event. I mean, it's striking for, I think, a lot of us that we lived through it. You sort of don't ever expect to live through something like that. And then all of a sudden it hits and there you are. And that preoccupies people, understandably. Now we have, for the first time in, for the first time in the lives of, the political consciousnesses anyway, of a significant segment of the population, the potential of great power conflict with Russia invading Ukraine and threatening nuclear strikes if they're interfered with there. I mean, so those things are absolutely going to trump a provincial election. And so that's not surprising. And we really don't know how that's going to unfold. And so, we don't really know how the pandemic is going to unfold. We could see another wave. We don't know how the Russian invasion of Ukraine is going to unfold. So it's really difficult to predict what the information environment is going to look like in the upcoming provincial election. In terms of who I think benefits from the distraction, I think it's the Ford government, because people already know, who Doug Ford is, as has been said, and they know whether they're going to vote for the party or against it, I suspect, in all likelihood. But if you think of the competition between the Liberals and their Democrats, I think this undercuts somewhat the opportunities of the Liberal Party in particular to introduce their leader, who, even though obviously Ontarians know the Liberal Party, they don't know the new leader as well, Del Duca. And that, I think, is a real disadvantage for the Liberals. And if people go into the next election, as we mentioned and the poll numbers suggest, if the people who want Doug Ford out of office go into the next election split evenly between the Liberals and the New Democrats, then Doug Ford will be premier again, and the Conservatives will win a majority government. So, unless, you know, Horvath or Del Duca can really sort of pull ahead of the other, then I don't really envision any change in the political status quo in Ontario after the next election.
I want to thank University of Toronto political scientist Chris Cochrane. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us again next week on Ballot Vox.
Ballot Vox was hosted by Sam Graywall, produced by yours truly. Join us next week for continuing coverage of the upcoming provincial and municipal elections. I'm Jeff Chalmers. Thank you for listening. Talk to you then.